Chapter 55. Kip moved expertly through the undergrowth to his vantage, blinking between sub-red and visible light in the darkness, eyes searching for Shabir Shofra's body. The forest air between the old giant spruces was cool and soft, with thick curtains of fog. The fog was welcome. It dampened vision and noise both, so it would make Kip's superviolet signal flares visible only within a small range, thus limiting the dangers his men faced. They were deep in enemy-held territory, attacking a supply train full of black powder mined and refined in Attash, heading to resupply the White King's blood robes besieging Greenhaven. Destroying it would be good. Seizing it would be much, much better. Through all their recent months of raiding, Kip had carefully been building a profile for his Nightbringers. Unless they had an overwhelming force, they attacked during the day, often just before dark, so they could melt away into the night, relying on their superior woodscraft. That identified them as a force that relied on drafting, and as raiders, glorified bandits. Where other guerrilla forces traditionally exaggerated their numbers, Kip consistently understated his own, even when procuring food and supplies from merchants and friendly towns. He relied on Irene Malagos's quiet largesse to cover the shortfalls. It had been another of Tysis's victories, mollifying her furious sister for turning Antonius and refusing her orders to come home by making promises she and Kip would someday regret if they lived so long. They'd also had to trade intelligence for food. Irene was a merchant to the core. On the other hand, the woman wasn't going to let her only sister and favourite cousin starve or die out here because they lacked supplies. A further part of Kip's stratagem was that fire was usually a big part of their attacks, used with only the crudest drafting. First from necessity, as the ghosts learned Chromeria-style drafting, and later to hide how effective the mighty had been at training their new compatriots. The Kuni War Kip used everywhere. The ghosts' will casting he used more judiciously, mostly for scouting and for tracking and killing the Blood Robe's scouts. But the Nightbringers' ranks had swelled as their fame grew, and keeping secrets amid a growing army was a losing game, especially when your army included the giant grizzly Talach that was partnered with Con Arthur. Still, Kip's attempts at secrecy and the lightning-fast relocation that the skimmers allowed had borne fruit. Now it was time to push into the next stage of the war. Kip hoped that all meant the Blood Robes wouldn't be ready for a night attack of this magnitude. He found Shabil lying under some bushes at a good vantage point, her skin flushed the adrenal war blue of her people. He lay down beside her and clicked his tongue softly. Two mastiffs in heavy armour came up on either side of him. The Kuni War, the Dogs of Dawn, hadn't chosen their name at random. They'd kept war dogs for centuries. Getting the dog's handlers to agree to let willcasters close to those beloved hounds had been beyond Kip's persuasive powers. But somehow, someone in the willcasters' ranks had convinced the Kuni War that they cherished the animals they partnered with, and that the dogs would be safer with a human partner than without. Perhaps it had been that simple. Kip didn't know how it had happened. That was what it was to be part of a team. Others were out there doing things you never heard about to try to achieve the same goals you had. There was a sound low in the bushes, and a hound with droopy ears emerged. Shabil Shofra woke, and the hound shook itself as if it had been wet. Then it licked her as she reported. 60 oxen, somewhere around 100 men. Sarai's not good at counting that high, and their scents are all on top of each other. 62 horses, a blue drafter, 4 red drafters, red loxen, 2 greens. And, freshly dug earth? From fortifications, I guess. War dogs, Kip announced. Those are on you. Clear a path for us. Kip gave a few moments for the word to filter down his lines. Men were making the sign of the 3 and the 4, praying. Kip looked back at the massive hillock behind him that was Con Arthur's giant grizzly Talach. He really needed to have that talk with the Con about his brother. Not tonight, though. The giant grizzly was lying down so as not to upset any of the other animals more than necessary. Its head, helmed with blackened steel and yellow luxon over the eyes, bobbed in assent. That and a small breastplate, well, small relative to a mountain, were all the armour the great bear would tolerate. Kip threw up a superviolet flare to signal the drafters to fill themselves with their torches, sharing lux torches and shielding them under blankets. The lux torches flaring made for a lot of night-blind drafters. Not all of them had at-will pupil control yet, but it couldn't be helped. He studied the trees for reflections of light from the torches and was pleased to see none. "Wolves," Kip said quietly. "Go." They tore off with the unnerving speed of the predators they were. They were to hit the camp first, silently, and take out as many sentries as possible. "War dogs, go." The mastiffs were off only slightly slower, all big shoulders and spiky armor and terrifying mass. If the wolves didn't raise an alarm, the war dogs definitely would. "Nightmares, go." It had been a joke at first. It wasn't a joke. Most of the nightmares were actual woodland ponies. Some were war horses, some were great elk. All were willcast and carried Kuniwar drafters on their backs. A willcast horse knew when you needed it to be silent, and the union of its animal dexterity with full human intelligence and discipline not to bolt despite the pressures of battle and magic and snarling animals on every side, meant every one of them was at least the equal of a well-trained veteran warhorse. Kip turned and found Tullock waiting, snout low and level to the ground. Kip stepped up and grabbed the horns of his platform. One didn't ride a giant grizzly. Its mass was too great for human legs to straddle, and if you somehow strapped yourself on, the undulations of its great form when it ran would break you. Instead, Ben-Hadad had designed something halfway between a saddle and a howdah. Kip, sometimes joined by Kruxa, could stand and stabilize himself with one hand on any number of grips, while either drafting or firing one of the many muskets attached to the platform's racks, or he could sit and lock his legs into place, whether Tullock was on all fours or rearing up on his hind legs. Whether it terrified the enemy or Kip more, he still hadn't figured out. "Nightbringers," Kip commanded. "At a walk. Advance." For those beyond the sound of his voice, he threw up a superviolet flare, shielded like the first, to radiate light only toward his own lines. A superviolet drafter looking into superviolet might still notice the light on the branches of the trees, but if you have to speak during a stealth attack, it is still better to whisper than to shout. "Tullock!" But the bear and the man inside it didn't wait for the complete order. Kip held on to two horns of his howdah and absorbed each loping impact with the ground with his knees. It was terrifying that something so large could move so quickly and dexterously. He ducked and bobbed and prayed while Tullock wove around the spruces that had branches low enough to sweep Kip off. The giant grizzly was still fast enough to almost close the gap with the nightmares before they hit the camp. The first cries that rose into the air were cries of surprise, not alarm. More yelps of, "What the hell was that thing that just ran past me?" than fear. The wolves went only for the sentries and the men with torches. Where the wolves had slipped easily through the gaps in the sharpened stakes ringing the camp, the mastiffs had to pause to muscle their way in. Two teams of them stopped to clear lanes through the stakes for the horses and men coming up behind them, while the rest of the mastiffs streaked on, hunting anyone with a stench of drafting on him. The tenor of the cries changed immediately as they began bursting through tents and tearing out throats. The nightmares rolled like distant thunder on the horizon into the camps next, streaming like twin lightning strikes through the two paths the war dogs had cleared, with Kip and Tullock hard behind them. The Nightbringer drafters riding on the nightmares splashed green or blue orange Luxin down on every fire to smother it, from the smallest torch to the cook fires, engaging only those blood robes who directly stood in their way. The White King's camp was plunged into darkness, and blindness for most of the humans who were so bad at seeing at night. Blood robes, spinning, startled by the streaking shapes, fired their muskets blindly, hitting nothing or hitting their own comrades. Tullock simply jumped over the stakes, ringing the camp, his gait hardly changing. When they landed, Kip finally had time to grab a flash grenade from his belt. His job was to guard Tullock's back, which mostly meant to distract and delay anyone who attacked him. A blood robe soldier knelt with flint and steel, trying to light a slow match for his musket, each scritch and flare of sparks an invitation to death. Tullock's claws answered the call with a quick, bloody swat. Then Kip saw the sudden starburst of mag torches being broken open at the center of the camp, near the wagons. Tullock saw it too and charged straight for it. His path took him over tents and through a dozen men trying to hand out muskets, whom he scattered like chaff. In a bound, he leapt over a picket of whinnying horses. Then, from the high vantage that only Kip had, the disaster opened in front of him. The central pavilion contained nothing except a great pit. One of the mastiffs must have inadvertently knocked down one of the supports, or had already fallen in. A pit that big could only be for Tullach. A trap. Kip yelled in alarm, but Tullach had too much momentum to stop. Instead, he tried to leap all the way over the pavilion and the pit. He wasn't going to make it. Kip leapt from his platform as Tullach came down, crushing the pavilion and hitting the far edge of the pit. Kip flung the flash grenade toward where he thought the mag torches had been. A fraction of a heartbeat later, he hit the ground. He rolled perfectly. Iron Fist would have been proud, but Tullach had been running at terrific speed. Kip flipped and flipped, trying to keep his limbs in. A flash split his vision, and he hoped that had been the grenade, and not his head hitting a rock. Somehow he found himself on his feet, only slightly dizzy. There was a strong stench of tea leaves and tobacco. Someone had drafted a lot of red Lux in here. But he was more worried about the four whites in front of him, each carrying a lit mag torch. Two of them appeared to be blinded and dazed from the flash, one, a blue, bolted. One of the dazed whites lifted a pistol in Kip's direction. It pulled the trigger, noticed that nothing happened, and cocked the hammer. Then it disappeared in a blur of fur and saliva and snarling. Coming in from the side, a mastiff had clamped its jaws on the white's gun arm and whipped him around. The war dog outweighed the man and had hit with great speed. The white was flung aside, and in moments the snarling dog was atop him, this time knocking aside frantic arms and going for the throat. Kip turned and spiked the other dazed white before it could recover. He saw another white he'd missed before as the young woman drew an arm back and threw her burning mag torch toward the hole. The hole. That was where all that red Lux in Kip was smelling must be pooled. Tullach was half out of the massive hole, recovering from his shock, claws piercing the ground, back legs churning for a grip, fur smeared with pyre jelly. Kip shot out a dozen fingers of fast superviolet at the arcing mag torch, each streaming a line back to him, one hit, and along that guideline, Kip threw all the last of his orange Lux in. The burning mag torch was blasted safely away from the pyre jelly and into the distance. Something knocked Kip off his feet as a musket went off, deafening him. From his back, he saw a war dog atop the white who had thrown the mag torch. A musket lay on the ground beside her. She was limp already. The dog whipped her back and forth, his jaws clamped around her neck. It must have knocked Kip down to save him. But Kip was already scanning the distance for the blue white who had run away, and he found him. He hadn't run away. He was running toward the wagons laden with black powder, mag torch in hand. Figures illumined only by that bobbing star flashed and shifted as the two camps fought, shadows in a night made darker by the contrast. The sprinting white wasn't 30 paces from the wagons. Kip had only a little superviolet and yellow left. Still lying on the ground, he shot out the yellow as hard as he could. The molten yellow twisted in the air, connected to Kip's will by trailing tendrils of superviolet. In midair, it solidified and curved. The projectile connected with the blue-white's head, but it hadn't totally solidified. A failure. It splashed into light. But Kip was already up and running after the white. The white had fallen. Being hit from behind while running, even by a fist of water, had been enough to knock him off his stride. The blue-white staggered to his feet and picked up the burning mag torch, mere steps from the wagon. A Cuniwar soldier ran in from the darkness and clubbed him with the butt of his blunderbuss. But it was a glancing blow to a shoulder, and the hit spun the white between the soldier and the wagon loaded with black powder. The Cuniwar soldier lifted his blunderbuss. "No, don't shoot!" Kip shouted, running. "Oof!" He tripped over a body in the darkness. The soldier looked back, whether he understood what Kip had said or simply thought it was another attack. He squinted against the darkness, unable to see Kip, and died as the white's blue spikes rammed through his neck. The white released the spikes back to dust and switched the mag torch from his wounded left hand to his right. He lofted the torch and jerked forward several paces as Crux's giant elk rammed its antler through his back. The giant elk lifted the white high in the air, but even then the white didn't drop his torch. Crux's first stab missed as the giant elk's animal instincts took over, and it tried to shake the white off its antlers. Then it paused and lowered its head, about to buck the white up and off the tines of its antlers. The white threw the torch. But Cruxo threw himself backward, so he was lying on the giant elk and, upside down, swung his spear, slapping the torch off to one side. His momentum carried him, and he flipped off the giant elk's back just as the animal flicked its head upward. The white flew into the air, and somehow Kruxa flowed into position, his spear butt planted on the ground. The white landed, his momentum impaling him on Kruxa's spear. Kruxa took his hand out of the way at the last moment, casually releasing the haft of the spear, and then taking it back as the white thudded to the ground. He spun the spear, its blade slashing the white's throat, and stepped out of range, eyes already looking for any other threats. He gave a command to the giant elk, and it charged off. Kip kicked dirt over the torch and walked to join Kruxa in guarding the wagons. The Kuniwar soldier was dying nearby, holding his throat, gurgling, his eyes on Kip, accusing him of betrayal. "You were going to shoot a blunderbuss toward a wagon full of black powder," Kip told him. "You would have killed us all." But the soldier was beyond hearing. Moments later, the rest of the mighty swept in and surrounded Kip.
"What are you doing?" Big Leo shouted. "We've been looking everywhere for you."
"Why isn't Dalak with you?"
Ben Haddad asked.
"How did we manage to lose him again, mighty?" Kruxa demanded.
"It's a trap," Kip said over labored breaths, still trying to yawn away his one deafened ear from the musket blast.
Was a trap. Fire. Wagons. Black powder."
Con Arthur, animating Talak, must have realized that coming to help Kip keep the wagons from blowing up when Talak was utterly soaked in pyre jelly was not the best idea. He'd gone elsewhere. The other possibility, that he had run away, was simply impossible.
"These are rigged?" Ben Haddad asked, from atop his nightmare. "Then what the fuck are you doing right next to them?"
But for the next minutes, they kept everyone away from the wagons. Not that any of their foes had any interest. Most of the men had no idea they'd been bait for a trap. The camp had been broken now. It left Kip with a few minutes. His officers knew their work and didn't need him interfering, and he was too valuable to risk himself at this stage when the battle had already been won. He looked at the mighty. They'd sharpened in these last months, and all of them had their halos at least half full. Ben Haddad had crafted some device to move his crippled knee and spent hours a day wincing, tears sometimes silently streaming down his face, regaining a range of motion. Big Leo had grown a heavy beard and picked out his hair to a large dark halo. He wore spiked gloves and carried a heavy chain into battle now. He'd joined Con Arthur in his exercises and tried to eat only what the Con ate, envious of the man's ridiculously muscular upper body. Farkudi had picked up a scar exactly where he parted his hair, from the top of his head down to one eyebrow. It was the only goofy scar Kip had ever seen. Only Winston seemed unaffected by all the fighting they'd done and death they'd seen. He'd saved countless friendly lives with his marksmanship, but had taken two. He'd reported those himself, but seemed unburdened by it.
"He dodged left for no reason. Arrow was already in the air."
His bow had been shattered during an engagement where he'd apparently saved many Kuniwar lives, and they'd given him a new one in thanks. Or, more appropriately, an ancient one. It had a sea demon bone worked into the spine of the bow, and its mammoth tension could be strung only by will casting. Winston was able to learn enough of that art for the bow, and his eyes lit with real joy when he tested the draw for the first time. Ben Haddad had, of course, wanted to study it immediately. 6 months, Kip thought. Halfway through our halos, in 6 months. That meant they had 6 more months, at the most, fighting this way.
Orholm's balls, just at the time they reach their full capacities as warriors, I'm going to have to take all these guys off the front lines completely.
The other options were, of course, impossible. Tell drafters fighting for their lives not to draft, or let them draft all they wanted and then just kill them when they broke the halo. Still, what 19-year-old was going to take retirement well? From the screams, the blood robes who had fled into the woods were encountering the will-cast jaguars and mountain lions waiting there. In the darkness, those who fled had no chance. As far as the White King was concerned, these wagons would simply disappear. No. This had been a trap. A sacrifice. That meant the White King would want to know how and if it had worked, or why it hadn't. Kip said,
"There would have been at least one scout stationed to see if the trap worked. The pit was to kill Talak. The black powder was to kill me and as many of the rest of us as possible. So, 2 scouts at least."
Kip looked around.
He couldn't see the hills in the darkness, but he'd memorized the map of this area. If the White King had been expecting a huge explosion, his scouts wouldn't need to be close. But if you wanted to see how many of the enemy you killed in that explosion, you had to have a sight line. Send the hounds over to that hill there, and get the war dogs going up Tenling Rise over there. Send some mounted men with them in case it's a long pursuit. The one on the rise will be mounted. Try for speed. The orders were relayed, and Kruxa said, "Now will you please get your ass away from here, Breaker?"
"You forgot to say, my lord," Winston said, his yellow-veined eyes sarcastic.
Carelessly he flipped back the canvas covering the wagon's payload. It revealed cannonballs and stones and iron nails, all tied tight around a dozen casks of black powder.
"Yep, that's a trap, all right," he said blithely.
"Are you insane?" Ben-Hadad shouted at Winston. "That canvas could have been booby-trapped. It should have been booby-trapped, you idiot."
Yeah, let's get to a safe distance," Kip said. "No, my lord's necessary." But in the back of his mind, the danger wasn't Winston. The White King had been willing to sacrifice several hundred men, half a dozen whites, and many casks of black powder just to kill Kip and Talak. So they knew about Talak. He was always going to be the first secret that slipped, of course. People on either side would love to talk about a giant grizzly. But that the Blood Robes had thought it was worth losing many men to kill Talak? That meant the raiding phase of Kip's war was well and truly finished. Kip's raiders needed to become an army now. That meant giving up sapping the enemy's strength and trying to destroy him directly. Kip had hoped that eventually some other satrapy would send in its men to do the large-scale killing and dying, while he simply weakened the Blood Robes. That fantasy was dead now. No one was going to help them. This was their fight alone. They'd won here tonight, but they come damn near a disaster. If all the White King had to do to lure Kip in was put some supplies in danger, he was going to get him eventually. In a way, it was encouraging. A leader wouldn't spend that many lives and that much material to try to take out two enemies if he could kill them more cheaply. That meant the White King didn't have any zealots willing to trade their lives for Kip's, or any professional assassins in Kip's army. Yet. Which likely meant the next attempt would be a while. But when it came, Kip might have just made himself worth the expense of hiring a shadow from the Order of the Broken Eye.
"Kruxa," Kip said.
"Hmm?
Remind me to give you a medal."
"Sure," Kruxa said.
What had once been thin streaks of blue in his eyes were now perfectly horizontal and vertical bars that nearly glowed with amusement despite the strict professionalism of his expression.
"Wait, no. Remind me to make up a medal first so I can give it to you."
"Uh-huh," the commander said, using a rag to clean the gore off his spear and hands.
"Order of the Skewer, maybe?" Kip suggested.
Finally, Kruxa cracked an unwilling smile. He shook his head.
"You know, you can just say thanks."
"Thank you for saving my life, Commander," Kip said gravely.
"No thanks required, sir."
It was Kip's turn to smile.
"That's it. You're getting that damn medal."